Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring a really distinctive way of looking at history. It's one that uses a very narrow lens, you could say, to see some very big things.
Yeah, it seems a bit backwards at first, doesn't it? Focusing really intensely on just one person, maybe, or a tiny community, or even a single kind of weird event.
Right. But the idea is that this focus lets you grasp these, well, these huge historical forces. The source material you shared, it calls this approach microstoria sometimes.
That's the one. And it's exactly about that kind of intensive small-scale analysis.
So the point isn't just studying small stuff because it's small.
No, not at all. It's really a strategic choice. It allows for a level of detail and nuance you just couldn't get otherwise. And that helps you see larger historical questions, social structures, cultural patterns, see them in a totally new light.
And often bringing up perspectives that get missed in those big sweeping histories.
Precisely. You get the voices that are often drowned out.
It sounds like a way to challenge the standard stories, maybe, to really grapple with how complex the past was by zooming way in.
Yeah, one of the studies we looked at describes it as a method to understand not just what happened, but crucially, how it was lived, how it was experienced, you know, on the ground.
And by looking that closely at lived experiences, you can actually sort of test the big theories, see if they hold up against the messiness of real life.
That's a huge part of it, checking those grand narratives against concrete reality.
Okay, so using the study you sent as our guide, let's trace where this approach came from, dig into its core ideas, and then look at some examples, because the examples sound fascinating.
They really are. It's a journey, like you said, from the tiny detail outward.
All right, origins first. Where did this way of thinking really get formalized, according to the sources?
Well, the formal name microstoria and the movement around it, that's pretty clearly traced to Italy in the 1970s. It really came together around a journal called Quaderni Storici, and figures like Carlo Ginzburg, Giovanni Levi, they were central.
So it didn't just pop up out of nowhere. It came out of a specific time, a specific intellectual climate.
Absolutely. The sources make it clear it was, in large part, a reaction, a critique of the dominant ways history was being done then.
What kind of dominant ways?
Things like large-scale quantitative studies, big social science models. People felt those approaches, while useful, sometimes flatten things out too much. They could kind of obscure individual agency, you know. The choices people made, the unexpected turns, the actual feel of living through a certain time.
So a pushback against history feeling too.
Yeah.
Predetermined, too neat.
Exactly that. And it even included critiques coming from within parts of the left. Some felt that certain, let's say, rigid Marxist frameworks presented history as this inevitable march. They didn't leave enough room for individual action or for history going down unexpected paths. They wanted to understand what one source called the tragic, theoretical, and practical impasses, the things those big narratives couldn't quite explain.
And looking at individuals, small places, that was a way to find those messy bits, those unexpected turns.
It was a way to bring the complexity of human action back to the center. By focusing on specific lives, you could potentially give voice to experiences that felt ignored by those overarching abstract theories.
Did this shift in focus change the kinds of sources historians started looking for?
Oh, definitely. There was this renewed interest in documents often created by, well, by institutions of power. Things like Inquisition records, court documents, local administrative accounts, stuff like that.
Documents not really meant to capture everyday life, then?
Not usually, no. But in recording conflicts or legal troubles or religious investigations, they accidentally preserve these incredible fragments of ordinary people's lives and beliefs. The big challenge, then, was figuring out how to read these records critically, often against the grain, as you mentioned.
Reading against the grain, yeah, that sounds like detective work. Hunting for clues the document didn't intend to leave behind.
It's absolutely fundamental, and that really leads us straight into the core principles of the method. What strikes you as the most obvious one?
Well, it has to be the reduced scale, right? Deliberately focusing on a small, specific area or event. But the sources emphasize it's not about limiting yourself. It's a tactic for intensive examination to get that incredible depth of detail.
Right. And that intensity enables the next step, detailed analysis, just really meticulous, close reading of every scrap of evidence you can find, constantly questioning assumptions, aiming for a truly nuanced understanding.
But it's not just staring at the tiny details in isolation. The crucial next bit is contextualization. You have to keep linking that specific case back to the bigger picture, the wider historical narrative, exploring how the small thing connects to larger patterns.
That connection, that bridge between the micro and the macro, is everything. And then there's the idea I find really intriguing, the normal exception, eccezionale normale in Italian.
Okay, tell me more about that.
It's the idea of studying outliers, unusual cases, not just because they're strange, but because they can paradoxically shine a light on the things that are so normal as to have not been previously noticed.
Ah, because when someone breaks the rules or stands out, it suddenly makes the unspoken rules visible. It highlights the boundaries.
Precisely. And often, these are the very people or events that did catch the attention of the authorities, which means they're more likely to be documented in the first place.
So you use the archive's bias, its tendency to record the unusual, to your advantage.
Exactly. You use it to reveal the contradictions of normative systems. It's quite clever, really.
It is. And there's also a strong emphasis on people's ability to act, on agency.
Yes, very much so. Understand the experiences and perspectives of individuals and their capacity for action. What the sources call protagonismo sociale, their social agency, even within all the constraints they faced. It's about putting the human back into history, pushing back against views where people are just puppets of larger forces.
And telling these individual complex stories often involves using a narrative form.
Right. The sources talk about this quite a bit. Narrative makes the history engaging, accessible, obviously, but it's also seen as a methodological tool. It forces the historian to confront the gaps, the ambiguities in the evidence, and it helps show the fluidity and openness of systems as people actually live them.
And underpinning all of this is that critical approach to the evidence itself, the source scrutiny or the indiziary paradigm.
That's Carlo Ginzburg's term, yeah. Drawing that parallel between a historian and a detective sifting through clues, it demands really meticulous, careful analysis, especially when you're reading against the grain of records produced by power. And it means acknowledging up front the ambiguities and partialities, the limits of what we can know from these traces.
So the historian is always doing this balancing act, intense focus on the detail, but constantly critically connecting it outward. The specific sheds light on the general gives context to the specific.
That's the dynamic tension, yes. The specific case isn't supposed to be statistically representative. It's meant to illuminate mechanisms or logics or possibilities that might have been much more widespread. And as we said, realizing the archive itself isn't neutral, it often documents crisis or conflict, is key to reading it critically. It's an implicit protagonist, as one source put it.
That makes sense as a framework, but let's talk specifics. Who were the historians who really put this into practice? Who pioneered it?
Well, Carlo Ginzburg and Giovanni Levi are definitely foundational figures, especially in that Italian context. Ginzburg is particularly known for critiquing those big quantitative approaches and for really championing that indiziary paradigm, finding big meaning in minimal clues or individual cases.
And he wrote the book that really launched this whole thing into the spotlight.
The Cheese and the Worms, yeah. Published in 1976, it's probably the most famous microhistory out there.
The Cheese and the Worms. What's the story?
It focuses on Domenico Scandella, this 16th century Italian miller, usually called Minocchio. He was hauled before the Inquisition multiple times for heresy, and Ginzburg managed to reconstruct Minocchio's incredibly unique cosmology, his ideas about the universe almost entirely from the trial records.
Cosmology? What did he believe?
He had this idea that everything originated from chaos, like cheese curdling.
Yeah.
And the worms that appeared in the cheese. Those are the angels. And God, too. It's wild.
Cheese and worms. Okay, definitely an exception that would get you noticed by the Inquisition. What did Ginzburg take away from this one miller's strange ideas?
Ginzburg's big argument was that Minocchio's ideas weren't just random. Yes, he'd read some books, but he interpreted them through the lens of his own oral peasant culture. It acted as an interpretive filter. So the book became this incredible window into the complex interaction between high, learned culture and low popular culture in early modern Europe.
Yep.
Its significance was huge. It showed the power of the method reconstructing a whole worldview from one life. And it showed how you could use Inquisition records, documents meant to condemn and silence, to actually recover the voice, the mentality of the person being persecuted, reading against the grain in action.
Using the tools of oppression to understand the oppressed, that's powerful stuff.
It really is. And then you have Giovanni Levi, another absolute key figure. His focus was often more on social networks, economic strategies, how people navigated the system.
He did a major work in this vein.
Inheriting Power, published in 1985. This one looked at a specific village, Santina, in 17th to 18th century Italy. He focused quite a bit on an exorcist priest, Giovanni Battista Chiesa, but used all sorts of local records, notarial, church archives to map out land ownership, power dynamics, social ties, and the whole community.
An exorcist priest, another normal exception, perhaps. What did Levi find in Santina?
Levi developed this really interesting concept of immaterial inheritance. He argued that things like your social connections, your reputation, your influence, who you knew, basically were incredibly important forms of capital, often more important than land or money, especially when times were uncertain.
So not just what you owned, but who you were connected to.
Exactly. He showed how individuals made strategic choices, who they married, what work they did, who they allied with to navigate their world and gain advantage. It highlighted their agency. It challenged economic history's focus just on formal markets or material wealth. Levi showed how value and power were deeply tied to concrete social situations and how people could cleverly use the ambiguities or gaps in the system. Power was relational, it was local, it was contested.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady's here. Rojbosh, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Rojbosh.
Let's see, how is it today? Ooh, smells good.
Let me try. Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
Maybe a tiny bit bitter today. Just a touch.
You think so? Maybe just a little.
Yeah.
Could use a fraction more sugar for me, perhaps. But still lovely. Thanks, Hannah.
Yes, thank you. Delicious as always.
Okay. Chai acquired. Where were we? Ah, yes, these pioneering works. Ginsberg, Levi. They showed the range from cosmology to village economics. But this approach moved beyond Italy, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Natalie Zimon Davis was hugely important in bringing microhistory to a wider international audience. She was definitely influenced by the Italians.
And her famous case?
The Return of Martin Guerre, 1983. Huh. It's based on this really sensational 16th century French court case.
The
posture, yeah. This guy, Arnaud Dutille, shows up in a village claiming to be Martin Guerre, a man who'd left years before. And he convinces almost everyone, including Martin's wife, Bertrand de Rolle, for several years.
How on earth? That's incredible. What did Davis explore through this?
Well, using the court records, especially the account written by one of the judges, Jean de Cora, she dove into questions about identity. Like, what was identity in a peasant society back then? How did people know who someone was? What counted as proof? And she offered this really nuanced reading of the wife, Bertrand. Was she fooled? Or were she maybe, possibly, a willing participant for a while, navigating her own difficult situation within a patriarchal society? It raised fascinating questions about female agency.
Wow. So one bizarre court case opens up identity, community, gender roles.
Exactly. The book was hugely popular. It showed the potential of the method for exploring these big themes, identity, gender, even the inner lives of ordinary people through these anomalous events. But it also sparked a lot of debate, you know, about how much historians can speculate, how they construct narratives from patchy or contested evidence. It really highlights how tricky establishing historical truth can be, especially from legal records, which are themselves constructions.
And then Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Her work sounds different again.
Yes, a real landmark, especially in American social history and women's history. Her book, A Midwife's Tale, which won a Pulitzer in 1990.
And her focus wasn't a dramatic event.
No, quite the opposite in a way. It centered on the life of Martha Ballard, who was a midwife and healer in rural New England, late 18th, early 19th century.
And the source.
This is the amazing part. It was Ballard's own diary. She kept it pretty much daily for 27 years. It wasn't overly reflective, more like a log. Births attended, remedies given, weaving done, visits made, goods exchanged.
So the texture of everyday life recorded by the woman living it.
Precisely. And Ulrich masterfully used this seemingly bare-bones diary to reconstruct the absolutely crucial but often unrecorded economic and social contributions of women's work. Midwifery, healing, yes, but also textile production, managing the household, maintaining community networks, participating in a complex local economy based heavily on barter and exchange of services.
It makes visible all that labor that usually gets ignored in economic history.
Totally. It showed you could write powerful, significant history from these seemingly mundane private sources. It really drove home the point of history from below, recovering the experiences of ordinary people, especially women. It famously argued for the historical importance of well-behaved women whose lives didn't necessarily make headlines, but were fundamental to how society functioned.
Okay, now Eamon Duffy. He used this approach for the English Reformation.
Yes, Duffy's a major historian of that period. His microhistory is called The Voices of Morbath, published in 2001. It looks at how the enormous changes of the Protestant Reformation played out in one tiny English village, Morbath, between about 1520 and 1574.
How could you track that in one village? What were the sources?
He found this incredible set of parish accounts kept meticulously for decades by the local priest, Sir Christopher Trichet.
Parish accounts, like church finances.
Exactly. But they recorded everything related to the parish upkeep, the church goods, the rituals. And Duffy realized these dry accounts inadvertently documented the lived experience of religious upheaval. You see the community investing heavily in their Catholic traditions. Then you see the forced sale of church silver, the removal of statues, the reluctant purchase of the new English prayer book, hints of resistance like involvement in the prayer book rebellion.
Wow, so the financial records become a narrative of trauma and change.
Precisely. It brings the massive abstract story of the Reformation down to the human scale. You see the confusion, the loss, the resistance, the painful adjustments ordinary people had to make. It powerfully challenges any simple narrative of an easy or willing transition to Protestantism, showing the vibrancy of late medieval Catholicism at the village level and the trauma of its dismantling.
It makes you feel the impact of those top-down decisions.
Yeah. It shows how administrative records, read with care, can reveal cultural loss, impose change, and community response.
Okay, one more of these key examples. Robert Darnton and the Great Cat Massacre, that title alone.
It's a classic. From his 1984 collection of essays, Darnton took this really bizarre incident from the 1730s in Paris. Printing apprentices went on a rampage and, well, ritually killed hundreds of cats.
Why cats?
That's the million-dollar question. Darnton found an account in an apprentice's memoir, and he approached it using cultural history and symbolic anthropology, drawing on Clifford Geertz's idea of thick description. He argued the cat massacre wasn't just random cruelty. It was a deeply symbolic act, a form of worker protest.
How so?
Cats had all sorts of cultural baggage links to witchcraft, but also, in this print shop, the master's wife pampered her cats, treating them better, the apprentices felt, than the apprentices themselves. So the killing, which the apprentices apparently found hilarious, was a way to symbolically attack their masters, mock the social hierarchy, express their grievances through this ritualized violence directed at symbols of their perceived mistreatment.
So the key was understanding why they found it funny. That unlocked the meaning.
Exactly. Confronting the otherness, the strangeness of the past, why was that funny to them, becomes the engine for historical inquiry. Darnton treated the action itself as a kind of text to be decoded. It showed how historians could use anthropological tools to access the mentalities, the beliefs, the social tensions of the past, even through seemingly opaque or bizarre events.
These examples are just incredible. They show such a range, beliefs, economics, identity, gender, religion, culture, all through this focused lens.
And the method keeps expanding, as your sources note. People now apply similar intensive contextual analysis, not just to people or places, but to objects. Think of books like Mark Kurlansky's Cod or Salt.
Ah, right, where the commodity becomes the focal point.
Exactly. Or specific bounded events like volcanic eruptions or earthquakes. Even abstract ideas like the history of sleep or everyday spaces like shopping malls. These things become nexuses, points where you can trace broader forces.
Okay, but the sources also raise criticisms. The big one seems to be about generalizability. Can you really make broad claims based on one unusual case?
That's definitely the most persistent critique. People worry, you know, are the findings from Pinocchio or Martin Guerre just anecdotes? Can you really generalize from an exception? Is there a risk of overinflated claims, losing sight of the typical?
How do microhistorians push back on that?
They have several responses according to the material. First, they lean into that normal exception idea again. They argue that these unusual cases are often the best way to see the underlying norms and contradictions precisely because they pushed the boundaries and got recorded by authorities. They turned the archive's bias into a strength.
So it's not about saying everyone was like Pinocchio.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. The aim isn't statistical representativeness. It's often described as generalization by illumination. The case study sheds light on mechanisms, logics, possibilities that likely operate more widely, even if less visibly. Pinocchio reveals dynamics of cultural interpretation. Martin Guerre reveals anxieties about identity.
And the idea of using cases to test larger scale explanation paradigms?
That's another key defense. You take a grand theory about class or religion or the state, and you see how it actually plays out in the messy reality of one village, one life. Does the theory hold up? Often, the microstudy reveals variation, contradictions, a plurality of viewpoints that challenge those need monolithic theories. It shows systems are more fluid and open.
So most aren't saying this case is the whole story, but this case reveals something important about the whole story.
Exactly. Though some scholars do embrace singularization, just focusing on the unique case itself, most aim to build that bridge, to connect the micro and macro in an illuminating way.
What about the reliance on narrative? You said it's a strength, but the sources mention potential pitfalls.
Right. It's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
Narrative makes it engaging, helps explore lived experience. But there's always the temptation to smooth over gaps, perhaps, or speculate too much about motivation, psychologizing, some call it. And because you're often working with ambiguous or fragmented sources, the historian's interpretation that indiziary, clue-based reading is front and center.
Which brings up objectivity again.
It does. It demands a lot of transparency from the historian about their methods, the limits of the sources, the ambiguities and partialities. That critical reading against the grain is essential, especially with power-produced records. The narrative isn't just window dressing. It's part of the analysis itself.
And there's an ethical side to this, too, reconstructing lives, often marginalized ones.
Yes, the sources touch on that. There's a responsibility that comes with interpreting lives from records often created by those who held power over them. Acknowledging that power imbalance, being respectful, admitting uncertainty, these are part of the ethical dimension.
How does microhistory fit in with other historical approaches? You mentioned social history.
Yeah, there's a really strong kinship with history from below, that shared focus on ordinary people, on agency, on everyday life. Microhistory provides a powerful set of tools for doing that kind of history.
And cultural history, anthropology.
Huge connections there, as we saw with Darnton. That interest in mentalities, beliefs, symbols, rituals. Microhistory often uses anthropological concepts to understand culture not as a static thing, but as something lived, practiced, contested on the ground.
What about the Annales school in France?
A complex relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Inspired by the earlier Annales focus on social structures, but also a critique of the later focus on very long-term impersonal forces, the long durée, which microhistorians felt could erase individual experience. And as we said, it was partly a critique of quantitative methods, too, arguing they miss complexity in agency.
And now, how does it relate to something like global history?
That's a really interesting ongoing conversation. People are exploring how microstudies can illuminate global processes. How are huge things like colonialism or trade networks or the spread of ideas actually experienced and shaped at the local level? Microhistory can provide that crucial ground-level perspective, a reality check for abstract global narratives.
So wrapping things up, looking back over the sources, what's the big takeaway, the lasting value of this approach?
I think it's made huge contributions. First, giving voice to the voiceless. Finding the lost people in the archives. Second, revealing just how complex and diverse past societies were, pushing back against simplistic views.
And methodologically.
It spurred real innovation in how we read sources, the clue hunting, reading against the grain, grappling with archival silences, and has provided this essential counter-narrative to purely deterministic views of history by constantly highlighting individual and collective agency, choices, and strategies.
It feels really relevant, actually. In our world of big data, grand narratives, this focus on the specific, the human scale, the plurality of viewpoints, it feels important. Levi said it stimulates a myriad of different readings, right?
Exactly. And for you listening, there's that potential for real connection. When you immerse yourself in Minocchio's world or walk alongside Martha Ballard through her diary, you gain a different kind of understanding, a historical empathy.
And the method itself, the focus on clues, ambiguity, interpretation, it makes you think critically about how we know anything about the past. It's not just receiving facts. It's understanding the process of constructing historical knowledge.
Absolutely. And many of these great microhistories explicitly embrace that ambiguity. They leave you with questions, suggesting that historical understanding is always an unfinished process, always open to more exploration.
It really shows that immense insight, real human drama, and a deep understanding of culture and society can truly be found by looking incredibly closely, by immersing yourself in the miniature.